Barton from Los Angeles. Welcome to the show, the podcast. Today I've got none other than Trader Vic, Victor Sparandio, calling in from Dallas, Texas. How are you doing, Victor?
Hi, Mike. Fine, thanks.
I prefer calling you Victor. I actually don't care for the Trader Vic moniker. I know that's what's on all your books or whatever, so that's why I call you Victor or Mr.
Good.
Victor. Now, let's go right into it. I want to talk to you about the markets and the equity markets. You know, markets can bottom for a long time, like you delineated in Methods of a Wall Street Master, like they did from, say, 71 to 81 when you were very active. Are we now in, like, another 1982? Or is this more like the mid-70s where we had almost like a two-year kind of rally, like an 80% rally off the lows, for example?
Well, in the 82 bottom, first of all, the market had topped in 1980. It was the bottom came in an inflationary environment, and interest rates had been, as you remember, the prime rate, I think, went to 21.5%. T-bills were in the teens. And the bottom came fundamentally with the lowering of interest rates. And that was a really easy bottom to see, and bonds rallied first and then stocks rallied. And it was the typical easing that was just beginning after a long decline and a spiraling down of inflation. This particular bottom, the difference is that, first of all, it came with a V and a gap overnight, a technical bottom, if you will, with really no important news of any kind. The news of the day was that they were going to stop short sales on downticks, and they were, and the government would eliminate the mark-to-market rule, and that's really an absurd fundamental reason for a bottom. It isn't the reason. It happened to create a short covering rally, and that's where the gap comes in. But there, I can't really find a bottom in history that came from a V after the kind of destruction we had, or even in minor destruction, that would come from something insignificant in a fundamental driven way. So to me, technically speaking and fundamentally speaking, this is still a bear market bottom. But to me, it's unique because of the V nature of it. It was driven by this short covering, by the elimination of the short sales rule. Now, why is the market rallied 35%? It is certainly a strong, much bigger rally than normal. It's actually corrected 90% of the decline from the January peak. And as long as you don't go above those highs, and even if you did, you'd still have to get an important correction and then a rally above that to become a bull market according to Dow theory. You also have to rally above the 200-day moving average, which it's nowhere close to doing that. So technically speaking, it's a bear market, and it's still a bear market, and the logic of why it's rallied so much is the fourth quarter, and the comparisons will be very favorable in the fourth quarter of this year, because even the most bearish economists, Nouriel Roubini is the Dr. Doom, they call him,
right,
and is his extreme bear, and he's looking for -2% GDP, and the bullish economists are looking for +2% GDP. And, of course, this year we had -6. So Wall Street loves these favorable comparisons. That's what it's rallying on. It's rallying on all the stimulus. It's going to cause a bounce in GDP. And that's basically the whole theme of this rally. So, but the key is, where is it going to go? And actually, I would believe that it's very premature to be a buyer here for December, or actually the news will come in January. And meanwhile, what is going to happen after you're up or down a little bit of GDP for one quarter, nothing really you can make the case that this is going to continue in any strong way, although that's possible. But I don't see the I see offsets in the stimulus program that hurt business, some of the tax increases that Obama is putting forth, many of the other programs that will increase taxes indirectly, like the oil, the tax on the hydrocarbons to what they call cap and trade. So it really isn't something that I firmly believe in fundamentally. Being an Austrian school economist, what he's doing cannot work. It's a demand-driven bounce is what it's going to cause, but it's not going to cause any long-term creation of jobs, and that's the issue.
I'm gonna. You're speaking to another fan of Friedrich Hayek. So let me get into this. First, we have the Greenspan put. Now it looks like we have this Geithner put. You know, Hayek won the Nobel for showing that central banks intervention basically gives rise to a boom-bust cycle. I mean, did everyone not read their history? I don't want to sound sarcastic because sarcasm's a poor man's wit. But they make us feel prosperous when we should otherwise feel, the pains, if you will, of a normal market cycle. I mean, we seem, as far as the government's concerned, like we're a long way from Jackson Heights, if you know what I'm saying. What is Geithner, what history books has he been reading?
I agree. Well, no, they're all Keynesian, and basically it's not going to work. If it does work, it's going to lead to inflation, and that's going to be the next cycle down. and really, it's going to be a monster inflationary cycle, and it's going to be a major bubble for long-term government bonds. So it can't work, but let's assume for the moment that it does increase GDP. Well, I would give them that you're going to get that because, like I say, you've got so much stimulus in there. But the key is what happens after the bounce. Remember the last, stimulus package. We had a little bounce in June, July from last year's stimulus, and then the market just died. You've got deleveraging of credit cards. I mean, every day one of my friends tell me, their credit card line has been reduced. Their credit card's been canceled. I've had even a few of mine that I don't use, and I have no debt. And they're afraid that somebody's going to get laid off and therefore use their credit cards to live, which is the MO of today. So credit card deleveraging is probably going to get cut in half, and that's not my words. That's the words of a very well-known analyst whose name escapes me, a woman, but very, very well-known and called the shots right. And according to this analyst, $5.4 trillion in credit card debt is going to go to $2.7 trillion. So you cut that kind of debt in half, where is the consumer spending where our GDP rests on 70% of consumer purchases? If you cut it in half on credit card debt, I mean, there's no way you get that kind of kick. So also the talk right now of changing the rules of what banks can do with credit cards, that will stop the credit card issuance, because if banks can't in their minds make money the way they want to make money, maybe it's a rip-off in most people's minds, but the bottom line is the banks have been hurt. They can't make it back. They just cancel the program. American Express did that with their credit lines. They had Centurion Bank.
Right.
They just can't close the bank. They closed their deal. You can't have a line of credit in American Express anymore, and they've had that program in play for 23 years, and they just canceled that program. So all I can say is that you've got a lot of destimulus. The other thing is when you historically, and this is a big point, and it's never mentioned in the press, you have approximately $11 to $14 trillion in 98 bills, according to Goldman Sachs. They're the high number, and there's other estimates that are at the low number, and there's the range of what's in T-bills and cash on the sidelines. Well, that money is collecting, the last I looked, which was about 2 days ago, about 9 basis points.
Oh, my gosh.
And now it's up, probably might be a tad higher, but not much. And if you think about it, if you had $10 million in the bank at 9 basis points, you'd be making less than most bartenders in Dallas, especially women. I mean, you're 90 grand, they make 100. So the point I'm getting at is that when you lower interest rates to stimulate borrowing, it's normally a good thing because you get the multiplier effect.
Right.
But not when banks are not loaning. See, if banks are not loaning money, then you're not getting any stimulus. And meanwhile, you're taking money away from savers who were getting an average from 60, from 1985 to date, T-bills yielded on a compounded rate of about 460. Now 9 basis points to 12 basis points. So when you take that kind of money away from call the number or any way you want, let's call it 12 trillion, you've now taken about $700 billion out of the economy. All right, so that's gone now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then meanwhile, if you count what's in 30-year and 10-year bonds, there's another $500 to $700 billion in lower interest rates. So when you take that away, really, what have you got? You've got a neuter a stimulus package. What you put on one hand, you've taken away with the other. If the banks don't loan the money, and if consumers don't borrow money. So because there is, and you could ask any bank, their policy is not to loan money. They look at it as a huge risk because unemployment is accelerating at a hyperbolic rate. Therefore, they know that there's a direct correlation between bankruptcy, delinquency payments, and bad debt when unemployment is rising at such a fast rate. It has to be tapering off before they start to change their attitude. So they don't loan. And therefore, you get a de-stimulus, and you don't get the kick. So all I can say is, and that's not in the press at all. I've never seen it. But it is real, and it's there. So you really don't have the fundamental basis to a normal recovery. You have disincentives that are different this time. So there is a question mark, a big question mark, whether even though you get a bounce in the last quarter and maybe even the first quarter of next year that carries forward, what are you going to do after that? That's why I think that fundamentally still we're in a bear market, and technically we're in a bear market.
Yeah.
Now, it could prove me wrong, but that's where it is right now.
Well, that's why I wanted to have you on the call today after we had spoken on early Monday morning. You had said a few things that I really, you know, stood up straight and sat up straight and listened to. Just to prove your points, I know that J.P. Morgan has a lot of credit card debt exposure, and that's kind of – that might be a little comeuppance for Jamie Dimon, given some of the stuff that he's pulled off recently. And out here in Los Angeles, a good friend of mine is a couple of years older than me, has a FICO score of 702, which is pretty good. First-time home buyer in a powder town called Cheviot Hills, which is just south of 20th Century Fox. $1.3 million house, you know, which is normal for a first-time homeowner. They want 30% down. Mm-hmm. And for, you know, unless you're rolling up equity from a tax exchange of the proceeds of another sale, I don't know too many first-time homebuyers who are sitting on 400 grand at all in any type of a market, you know, never mind the type of environment that we're in right now. So that totally proves the point, at least this one person sample space, that the banks won't lend you the money unless you could almost prove to them that you don't need it. And it's the question I have for you, you know, if the dollar falls off because it has to, if they print so much of anything, if there's a surplus of corn, if there's a bumper crop in beans, there's a bumper crop in dollar bills, they have to be worth less all around. If that causes the 30-year to fall off, rates are going to go higher, and in the process, you'll see credit effectively tighten. Now, like you said, the 30-year bond has not necessarily metastasized right now, but How is a system that's already tied or practically shut down going to respond to this?
Yeah, it's the next bubble is in bonds, is in government bonds. And there's no way they can respond except go down in price.
I have a few more questions about the U.S., and then I want to get off. There's a couple of questions I have about what's going on overseas. You know, mutual friend of ours, Jim Rogers, said that if he was elected the Fed chairman, he would do two things. He would first dismantle the Fed, and then he would resign. And, I mean, that sounds great when you're on TV, and I think he actually believes that. There's no doubt, and I would be a fan of that too. But are there any practical steps that we could take to responsibly, you know, do away with the central bank? Because who in their mind that has that kind of power is going to want to give it up? You know what I mean? To my mind, nobody.
Yeah, I've written a book on this, The Crash Maker, where I answer it very succinctly and with a partner of mine in 1,600 pages. So very easy read. but in any regard, no, there is no easy answer from getting to a different standard than a paper standard. And it would take... It would be impossible politically. It would be impossible. It wouldn't go the way that we wrote the book. And to get on a gold standard, which is what the country was built on from 1776 to 1913, well, actually it was 1933 when Roosevelt confiscated all the gold and negated the gold contracts. But let's call it till 1913 when the Fed was started, they didn't do much in the beginning. The point is, right now, the way the system is set up, it would be impossible, disruptive to the system, where there'd be a lot of pain, so people wouldn't really move forward on it, and it couldn't be done easily. We're already in the soup. And the soup is boiling, and there's nothing we can do about it except try to survive as best we can in the hot soup. Sadly, like I say, the answers that I give would never be politically done. Mm. And to give you an example, what I suggested was the first thing you'd have to do is pay down the debt. and the debt is... in the $10 trillion range, known debt. That's not contingent liabilities. Well, how do you pay down how do you pay that down? The first thing you'd have to do is, one thing the government could do is sell all the land. I mean, the government owns over 50% of the land in the U.S., some of it very expensive real estate in California, where you live, Mike, I can't think of the Army base there in Southern California. I'm getting Alzheimer's here, but the point is that it's probably $250,000 a square foot, much less an acre. But the point is, if you sold off all the land, and if you can imagine, even in the Rockies, there's mineral rights and tar sands, and I mean, there'd be a lot of buyers, and then the debt could be paid down. Now, once that was done, the Treasury wouldn't have to borrow. See, so or they could, excuse me, they could borrow, and they wouldn't have to print. Right now, they do both, but really, we're getting away. I mean, like I say, this is a long topic. And right now, unfortunately, there is really no easy way to get from A to Z.
Well, that doesn't sound too promising, but if there's anyone who's lived through it, you would certainly have a good historical context. let's talk – I mean, I'm fed to the teeth to the point where I want to puke about the stress test. My gut opinion is that these are tests that they could already get the access to, and it's almost as if it's a PR campaign to maybe allay some of the fears of the marketplace. Tell me that I'm stupid, or, you know, that there's actually some meaning to these stress tests that they're doing.
I really believe this is a political play to, first of all, not allow the banks to effectively be free again. And as you remember, and it's amazing that it's not stressed on TV, the good banks were forced to take the money to hide who the bad banks were. So all these 19 banks were forced to take money from the government. Some of them didn't need it. Some of them did. Now Geithner had made several speeches that we got to focus on the whole, the group, if you will. This is a very, forgive me, collectivist kind of mentality and word speak, i.e. socialistic mentality. And because, again, a bank is owned by its shareholders. Why would it care about another bank that it doesn't own, you see? But if you think about the whole and you use that collective-like speech, you know that the fact is they're really selling an agenda here. And the agenda is to keep control of these banks and keep control of the executive pay.
Right.
And that's really one of the things you hear all the time is they just don't like people making a lot of money for whatever reason, whether it's deserved or not deserved. But the key here is that this stress test, it can be anything somebody wants it to be. And if 10 banks have to raise capital and they can't raise it easily in this market, it's just a slogan to keep control of the 10 banks to make them maintain their control. And it's also an excuse not to allow the other 9 to give back the money, because again, Geithner has repeatedly said we got to look at the whole. If we take money out of the system, if Goldman repays its debt and J.P. Morgan, two of the banks that want to repay, if you repay the debt, well, money comes out of the money supply, it gets repaid as debt, and now you shrink the money supply, and they're saying, well, that's bad for the system. So, to me, the stress test is just part of an agenda. There's no way to measure accurately what one person would think a bank needs under what conditions.
Except Warren Buffett. He said he could predict the future yesterday or the day before, but that's different. Sorry to cut you off.
No, that's fine.
He said that he knows what's best for Wells Fargo. He doesn't need any stress tests because he, quote, can see the future. And then a day after the shareholder meeting, it was reported that Wells Fargo is going to have to shore up their finances. So I'm sure he's bristling with that news. The military bases in the California, and I got confused because there's actually two. There's the Navy one in Coronado, way down in San Diego. Then there's actually a Marine base in it's actually North Oceanside, but they refer to it as Camp Pendleton. I think that was the one you were thinking about at 250,000.
Right. That's it. It's Camp Pendleton, right.
Yeah, I've been to both, and they're quite magnificent. You got to love those troops. They are amazing to watch them go through their practice. So I appreciate your feedback on the stress test. I'm glad I'm not the only one who's – and I don't want to sound cynical because it's so easy as a pundit to sit down and take pot shots at somebody. But, you know, when I look at what's going on, I can't feel like there's a good thing. And again, not to make an ad hominem attack – and I turned off my cable because I just can't bear to watch any of the financial channels anymore. I can't get CNBC even if I wanted to. I don't know what they're saying because it's just so banal. But when I do see Tim Geithner, and you and I are poker players, you know, not professionals, but we play competitively from time to time. I look at Tim Geithner, and again, not to give an ad hominem attack, but he just does not look like a confident man when he's speaking. He looks like he's a guy who's trading with weak hands. And I don't know, you know, if I was trading against him, either he'd be really bluffing, you know, his position, or you know, it seems like he's signaling something by the way that he speaks. Have you been able to pick up anything on that in the way that he speaks, in the manner?
I think he's been learned to speak the way he has, because he's parroting the administration's position. Not necessarily that he may agree or disagree, we don't know, but he's just parroting a position to maintain his power as the Secretary of the Treasury.
Again, and it's no dig on him. I wouldn't know what to do if I was in his position, but then again, I'm just happy being a humble little prop trader here. Let's talk about trading. You've been around for a while. You've traded lots and lots of things. You're the only guy who I know that can say they got a cold call from George Soros. You see this, these short selling rules. I don't care necessarily for the naked shorting. I think it's, it's one thing. But in terms of the uptick rule, I've seen it be in place. I saw them phase it out. What was it, a year ago, July? Now they want to put it back in. You've been everywhere trading options. You've traded the glamour stocks. You trade preferreds and bonds and blah, blah, blah. When you look at the short selling rule of all the rules that are out there, how material is that, the uptick rule I'm speaking about, to trading?
Okay, well, they tried to outlaw this in the 30s as well, and did. And it's one of the causes of why the 30s went down so hard and fast, because without short sellers, you take away a lot of, if you will, aggressive buyers, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which add to the, like the rally we're in now, a great deal of that, in my opinion, with short covering. But to make the case and point, generally when you have a bear market bottom, if you were to look back in history, when you do get a bottom of significance and markets begin to rally of this nature, volume is triple what it was near the end of the bottom. So in other words, volume dries up, the sellers are gone, there's very little volume, all of a sudden whatever the fundamental cause is takes place, and you get real investors barreling in, and they buy, and it's roughly three times in most all, and I've checked this, in major bottoms. Now, in this case, it's about 1.5 times what it was, so meaning on the way down, the average. So the point is that that's what makes me believe this is a short covering rally, because these are aggressive buyers, and there's a lot of shorts out there. But to answer your question, they've tried this before. Markets don't go down because of short sellers. They are more volatile because of short sellers, both down and then back up, as you've seen now. So they help the market and they hurt the market, but they don't cause the market to go down. So it really is now a more difficult concept, and that's because there's a whole industry built on ETF funds, exchange-traded funds, and mutual funds, who make a business of offering the fund as a short vehicle to give investors more of an option to hedge their longs. And unfortunately, they need the downtick rule to execute the fund if a client buys that fund. It has to be short. Now, what it would do, if you put the uptick rule back into play, would eliminate that industry. Now, I don't necessarily, I don't have an axe to grind for or against the industry, although I think the more tools available to free people, the more they can take care of themselves and better equip themselves for money, managing their money. But let's assume for the moment that, take my opinion out of it, the key is, you know, the worst case, you should allow the uptick rule, right? Because then you're not, the argument is you're not manipulating the markets down. So the uptick rule, by the way, I lived under the uptick rule from the late 60s on into when the rule was changed. And the bottom line is that it is not a harmful, let's say, trader's method of getting short. Actually, you should be shorting, if you're a professional, into rallies. You shouldn't be shorting weakness.
Right,
but
right.
That's just a theoretical. What professionals do is they wait for rallies and they sell into those rallies so they can get short. And it's actually a good entry point rather than selling weakness. Because if you sell weakness, you may be selling what's called a hole, or you may be selling poorly and then the market bounces and you've entered the market in an inappropriate place. The best way to short the market is when it rallying up towards, by the way, its 200-day moving average, which is where it's headed now, and there's resistance historically, actually. To give you a name, George Soros used that ploy as well. He used that technical phenomenon. The key here is that, you know, there's nothing wrong with short selling because it leads to buying. Warren Buffett echoed that. The point is, whether it's on an uptick or a downtick, it should be available. The question now is, if you eliminate the downtick rule, you eliminate the industry of funds that offer full 100% short or leverage services to allow people to hedge their longs.
Right, right, right. Let's talk about this tax thing that came out the other day, the foreign tax, and the government wants the president suggested that they would crack down. And whenever I hear the word crack down, it makes me think that there's something illegal going on, you know, like sweat labor or drug dealing. But, you know, because the United States is like the only country in the world, I think, maybe there's one other that wants to tax you no matter where you earn your money, right? They want to legitimize or they want to, I think, offset or minimize the amount of deductions that you can take that are legitimate expenses overseas, you know, before you pay your U.S. bound taxes or something like that. In my mind's eye, if I can find cheaper labor elsewhere or more skilled labor elsewhere, that's a competitive advantage that I have. It also helps me expand my brand because I'm going to be able to compete in a local market under local terms, right? Now, what do you think about this quote? He said, you know, it's more favorable tax-wise to hire somebody in Bangalore than in Buffalo. Like, the question here is, shouldn't the president and maybe even my governor here, Arnold Schwarzenegger, go out and recruit foreign companies to come to the U.S., thereby creating jobs for Americans and also adding even a discounted, you know, tax stream to our much-needed tax base?
Well, of course. And the only reason that we're losing jobs and not the only reason, a reason we're losing jobs and manufacturing has gone to China and to Ireland is, in Ireland's case, the tax rates are very, very low. And therefore, you're induced to build a company there because the profits you make from sales are, I think it's a 12% tax. It used to be less even, but now it's 12. Now, why would somebody want effectively a 35% rate if they can get 12? I mean, the whole world is built on these incentives, and the government knows that. So the fact is that you are incentivized to build your plants overseas. The other reason is when you try to help people by instituting laws such as Social Security and Medicare, Medicaid, unemployment insurance, disability insurance, all the things that the regulations in this country that are geared to help workers and you know, not necessarily that they're wrong or bad. It's just that as you raise the cost of something, you restrict what's going to come out of demand. And the demand in this case is corporate America who hires workers. So if you want a lower unemployment rate, you've got to make things more attractive for corporations to hire people. You can't raise the cost. If you raise the cost, you'll get less workers. So really what's happening is these manufacturing jobs of all kinds are being started overseas. China is the obvious example. I mean, I dare you to find a product of 10 products that you hold in your hand, have in your pocket, put in your back that doesn't say China on at least 60% of them.
Mm-hmm.
A BlackBerry a holding case.
Mm-hmm.
Is made in China. I mean, I looked it up the other day, and I couldn't believe it was about, you know, it was made in China. I look for things, and I say, well, this one's made in China. If you find something that's not, it's rare. And that's because their labor costs are extremely low. They don't have the kinds of benefits that our workers do, which is not a good thing, but the point is, that's where the jobs are going. This is a lot of people. And it's inexpensive labor, but that's the way the world works in a global economy. So, you know, if you try to help on one hand, you hurt on the other in the U.S. So yes, this is purely, if you will, this is the government trying to have their cake and eat it too. If you want to restrict, if you will, corporate America from operating overseas, you're putting our corporations at a disadvantage. Now, what does that mean? That means that foreign corporations will start to get the business, and they'll start to offer products cheaper. It'll worsen our trade deficit. It'll weaken our corporations. We will be at a disadvantage. We will start to have more corporations fail, and we will then have more unemployment. And it'll be like France has basically got an 11% core rate, that basically that's where employment stays, at 11% unemployment rate. Now, that's where we're heading. We're heading to a much higher core unemployment rate, because you're building in a long-term non-producing jobs market in the U.S. by trying to have your cake and eat it too. And it will not work.
Well, there's another place that I want to talk to you about that has, you know, 15% unemployment and probably 25% inflation, and that's inside the empire now known as Iran. But before I go to the Iran question, which is next, you know, we used to be a manufacturing economy, right? You know, coming out of even the Industrial Revolution. And we still do make some stuff, but for the most part now we are a service economy. I know a lot of the big three, that's unionized labor, and my dad was in a labor union. I have pros and cons personally that I think about labor unions, but given the fact that we are not really a manufacturing economy anymore, at least as a percentage of what we do, are the labor unions in the United States still relevant?
Well, unions, again, there's a good and a bad part of a union. The good part is they try by monopolistic means to get workers more power, i.e. more wages. It is a very inefficient method of doing it. It doesn't work. It causes disruptions via strikes. And actually, the companies that start businesses avoid unions because it is harmful to their P&Ls. And therefore, you now have a risk-reward. If you have, and let me put it into concrete terms, let's make believe you're someone that's been successful, you saved part of your capital, let's say you're Bill Gates-like, let's say not Bill, but let's say somebody like that, and you've got $500 million in the bank. Now, you have the opportunity to start a business, and you want to get into manufacturing, and you say, well, I've got all these rules, regulations, forced health care. Look what happened to GM and Ford, GM and Chrysler, and Ford to a major degree. they're suffering because they couldn't get around making deals with a monopoly, with a workforce that was a monopoly. So they gave them too good of deals, and now GM is virtually it is out of business. I mean, the only one that I'll applaud is Ford because they didn't borrow any money, but they're certainly not in good shape. They're losing money at a slower rate than the rest of the bunch. But the key is when you try to help people make more money, which is what a union does, the question is, in a monopoly situation, they can accomplish it, but it's to their own detriment in the long run. And what should a worker be doing if he wants to make more money? Well, he's got to learn skills that are more in demand than the job he currently has, which many people can do. So he has to basically go to school. He has to better himself. He has to learn new skills. And he has to work. He has to work harder. And they have to go to school at night. The key is he becomes a better person if he does that. Is better off because it has a more skilled employee who will get a better job. That's the option. But again, what you're trying to do here is have your cake and eat it too. You're trying to say, look, we want more money. We want guarantees. We're not going to be fired. But in the same vein, we really don't want to do anything more skillful for it. We just want it because we can get it because we're a monopoly. And, of course, that's why 2 and 2 don't add to 4, because in the long run, you wind up with a General Motors, and you'll wind up with a New Jersey pension plan. which is going to go bust in 14 or 15 years, maybe less, because there's too many good things offered to the unions. It's nice that they got it, but they're not going to be able to pay for it. So, you know, unions are really not a benefit to any country because they are inefficient costs.
Well, Jim Florio from New Jersey learned the hard way what it was like to have $2 billion worth of unfunded pension liabilities because it cost him a second term. Now, the government said a couple weeks ago that they were going to put up another $5 billion for the car makers. Honig from the Kansas City Fed said this is ridiculous. Joe Stiglitz at Columbia said they're not necessarily too big to fail. They're too big to save and they're too big to manage. I just want to put something to you from a Pareto optimal standpoint. You know, if the GM has, 29,500 workers, I read. Suppose we offered them each $30,000 in zero interest loans just because we're human. And if an industry is going to go by the wayside, we can't just throw them out on the street. They're going to be displaced workers. My math would show that that's about $900 million. And that's only 20% of the $5 billion package. To me, it would be far better to let the car company go out because, like, at election time, Victor, people vote their pocketbook. And what I can see from their voting, no pun intended, is that they don't want American cars if they can get better foreign products. So they voted their pocketbook about buying American cars. And instead of giving somebody who's been declared brain dead a new heart to try to save them, why not take old Yeller out back and put the dog down, even though it's sad, and then lend these folks some money, zero interest loan, so that they can not be dislocated and find a new home and make a transition and make a product that they can actually have some self-esteem around. I can't imagine going to work at any of these places that you feel good about what you do. I mean, is that ridiculous or is that too communist of me to think?
No, that's fine. It's just that politically what that group wants. And actually, you know, if you allowed the companies to fail, because they have real assets. I mean, they have plants, they have equipment, they have construction kind of manufacturing process
right.
That is robotic in many cases. Well, you can sell those, and what would happen is somebody would buy it. They wouldn't junk it. They would buy it. They would start building cars, buy at a cheap price, they'd start building cars, and they'd hire the same workers. Now, the same workers wouldn't necessarily get the same deal, so they would lose out on the deal, but that's why I say it's pay me now or pay me later. You can't have your cake and eat it too. You can't be overpaid and have an inefficient cost last forever. It is temporary. So the workers really asked for more than they efficiently should have gotten. The car companies gave it to them to avoid strikes. They are now paying the price that they're going out of business, and the shareholders are the ones that lost in this case, but also the union employees lose because their legacy costs are going to disappear. Their pensions, they're not going to get their pensions. They're not going to get their health care. It's going to be wiped out as well as many of like shareholder equity. So the concept is it's an attempt to change reality, change two and two. And it in the long run, it fails always. In the short run, you can manipulate numbers to where you can last for a while, but basically it comes out in the end, and this is the result. It's a perfect example is what happened in Detroit.
Well, I take no pleasure in saying, hey, if you're an employee, part of the risk that you take, because you do have risk, is that you could work for a sham outfit or you could be working for a guy like Philip Bennett at Revco. And I can tell you very, very clearly about how Hurricane Revco, you know, put one of my humble little entities out of business, you know, because they went insolvent in about 2 months after the news hit the tape that debt was bad. I could go on and on about the car thing, but I definitely want to get to what's going on in the Middle East. I read a great book on the Middle East that Robert Baer, the CIA operative, wrote called The Devil We Know. And he does a very in-depth study, knowing that, you know, that he's an expert, both Arabic and a Farsi-speaking expert in Iran. And, you know, we get to see Ahmadinejad, you know, saying the Holocaust never happened. And, you know, this is just a guy to me who's a punk and needs to get a pop in the face. But at the end of the day, Iran and Israel and Palestine and all of that stuff is effectively controlled by the Shia regime, the 12 Shia clerics who run Iran. Now, you said something very, very provocative on another call that we were on Monday. And I want to turn it over to you to give everybody who's listening your two cents on what you think is going on between Iran and Israel and what's imminent.
Well, all right. the key here is that Israel has elected what I call the Barry Goldwater of the U.S.
Netanyahu.
Netanyahu. And he's a very, very aggressive, strong-willed man and will defend Israel to the death. And he doesn't care about collateral damage. He doesn't care about U.S. policy towards them. If he feels Israel is at risk, he will undo that risk any way he can. And he's got a little bit of tact in him, and he's got a little bit of patience, but he doesn't have a lot. And he will use whatever means necessary. So that's the base. Trust me that is the base of the man. Now, when you have Iran suggesting that Israel should be wiped off the map, that the Holocaust never happened, and this is, you know, obviously these are mortal enemies with each, which Iran is acting as if Israel is a mortal enemy, but vice versa, they're making Israel into what they will become as mortal enemies. So the key here is now policy. And the policy is, and you'll follow the sequence, the Obama administration is a passive kind of administration. And they basically believe, because they're not stopping Iran from getting the bomb, a nuclear weapon, that it's the MAD concept, the mutual mass destruction, just like we in the Soviet Union. We each had a major number of these weapons, so one could not use them on the other without destroying themselves. However, the Arab mentality is far different. They basically believe that it's in their interest to die, and they go to heaven and with Allah, and it's a good thing. So they have no interest. They have no qualms about blowing themselves up, as you see all the time. The key is this: there was a very major mullah that basically said, look, if we wipe out Israel with a few atomic weapons, they're gone. They're dust. And then he put this into context of the Arab world. The Arab world would have nothing but damage. So in other words, here's where you are. You have an administration, a U.S. administration, that doesn't want Israel to attack Iran. You have an Arab mentality that basically says it's okay to die. And if many of us die, but we wipe out the mortal enemy, Israel, that's okay. That's a good exchange. So what you have now is Netanyahu, who knows this. If I know it, he knows it. And it is literally just a matter of when, where, how, and the time to get there before Israel takes out these, if you will, these productive capabilities of Iran. That will force Iran. Now, I'm not saying they're going to use nuclear weapons. Now, I'm saying they're going to take out the ability of Iran to produce nuclear weapons. That then would cause Iran to sink ships in the Straits of Hormuz and cause world disruption as payback, and therefore oil prices would probably go to $200 a barrel.
I was just thinking that, yeah.
So this is inevitable. I mean, it's just a question of, as I said, when. And the faster that Iran gets closer to the manufacture of nuclear weapons, the faster it is that Israel will have to take them out. And they really will not care about Obama, because it's their survival. So they're not going to say, well, you know, we don't want to upset the new leader in the West. You know, I'll call him the great leader. We're not going to want to upset him, and therefore we will sacrifice ourselves to the eventuality that we'll do what they say. Adolf Hitler said, let's kill all the Jews. Nobody seemed to believe him. He was a very serious guy. I mean, I watched films of the man, I would have believed them.
Yeah.
I would have absolutely taken this guy as serious.
Yeah.
And I think that the Arab mentality towards the Jews is an extremely serious mentality. When women blow themselves up, children, and they're willing to die, and they are groomed to die, and it's a good thing. They look forward to it because it's basically, it means they go to, you know, heaven. It's a good thing.
They're martyred. They're martyred. That's what they say.
They're martyred. It's a wonderful thing. But the point I'm getting at is that this can only lead to destruction. It can only lead to destruction. It can't lead any other way but this war. And it's like, look at Palestine and look at the Israel. I mean, they've been fighting for 50 years.
Right.
The 67 war that Israel won, they're still fighting. There's no way out of it. It's the same process that's going to happen with Iran. It's the same. And they're not at war yet, but they will be. Iran just knows Israel has nuclear weapons, so it wants to get nuclear weapons itself so it can counteract the hit back. So all I can say is it is a very, very bad moment, and the nature of the way that Obama is handling this is not good. I mean, there is no easy answer. I'll give you that.
Yeah.
There's nothing you can do that's good or easy, but this one is guaranteed to lead to very bad things. If Iran gets the nuclear capability to eliminate Israel, they will use it.
Well, this is the second pass, I believe, for Netanyahu, because somewhere in the mid, early to mid 90s, he was there, and I remember what he was going through with Arafat, and I too agree that he is a serious dude. You know, Bear refers to the martyrs as the ultimate smart bomb, you know, because they strap themselves up with C4 and they walk into anywhere and they're perfectly placed. You don't have to worry about Scud missiles and drones or whatever. They're the ultimate smart bomb. So they're very hard to defend against, as we're learning also in Iraq, right? I mean, they're doing the same things in Iraq. I want to put out a suggestion. I am no political scientist, but I do an enormous amount of reading. Not to your level, though. I haven't read as much as you have. But, you know, Iran is the second largest oil producer in OPEC after Saudi Arabia. Bear contends that they've been not necessarily forthright in how much reserves they actually have. And because of how things work inside OPEC, Saudi Arabia has perennially been overstating what they can do so that they get a bigger share of the current sales effectively. Bear suggests that Saudi Arabia has maybe 10 to 15 years worth of oil left. Now, being that could be a fact. Maybe he's right. Maybe he's wrong. But if Iran's number two, and if Iran's refining right now is very, very poor, whereas American refining technology, Victor, can bring them to, if my math is right, about 140% of their existing refining capabilities. Again, we're talking about creating revenues, creating jobs. to me, if I was Obama and I was a creative person, not just an Arthur Fonzarelli kind of president who's as cool as anybody. He walks into Arnold's economic shop and bangs the jukebox and out comes a great song about Blue Moon and how everything's going to be wonderful. I would be creative and send Hillary Clinton to speak, you know, in June with whoever the new president's going to be, because Iran's got an election coming up in about a month, and start talking to them about bringing American technology and refining to Iran, because they have high inflation, they have high unemployment, they live off their oil revenues. We create jobs, we create revenue, and if the Americans are there, or if American companies are there, we certainly can't stop them from hating one another, but Israel might think twice about chucking a few bombs over the Strait of Hormuz, especially given that Iran, when you look at the geography, controls about, you know, including what Iran effectively controls in Iraq, is about 90% of the circumference of the Gulf there. But I don't think our president is that forward-thinking, because he doesn't want to upset the lobbyists and the other folks. But, I mean, wouldn't that be a creative solution to the whole problem and get everyone to kind of just cool down?
Yeah, that's not an easy solution, though, but it is a solution. Mm. It's just not easy because, again, I think that Iran looks at the U.S. as evil as well. And you know, they really don't want us in their space.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't care about the economics.
Okay.
You know, they just don't care.
Well, that's my naivety. It just seems like in an idealistic world, it's tough being, you know, a libertarian watching what's going on out there, because I know that killing people for ideological purposes, although the states has done its share, is just not a good thing. You know, I don't support that at all.
Right.
Last question. You know, you have an encyclopedic memory. You have an amazing IQ. You've read every book there is to read on history, political economy, on trading. You know, speaking with you, it's, you know, you got faster responses than the Google, and you're 10 times more far reaching than Wikipedia ever will be. What could the new traders come out? People that want to even aspire to my level, Victor. What could they do now to increase, you know, besides turning off the TV and never watching it again like I've done? Can they read books? Should they go take seminars? What can you do these days if you want to become a new trader? How can you learn? And what are some of the things that you should be doing to increase your level of financial literacy?
Well, certainly in my growing up period in Wall Street, I read as many books as I could get a hold of, and I honestly would look for one paragraph in the book that would give me an edge or some insight, and absolutely, that is the process. Even though it's a difficult, long, tedious process, and if you read a lot of these books, they do become similar, but you'll find one or two that are exceptional, and I would say probably out of the thousands I read, there was probably 10 that were exceptional, that were, you know, that taught me something which led to making money. So you have to cull through them and find the good one. Now, there's many, many, many more that have been written since I was around, but the difference between reading books is that the writer has to put something into the book, and he has to do more research writing a book than you do. Then you do more research discovering what you're going to write than you do the writing. Now, TV shows are, you know, they're a show. They're Jay Leno. And I wouldn't be as hypercritical. Perhaps I would find one or two. I mean, Rick Santulli I love.
I like Rick, yeah.
He's a professional. And there's maybe one or so others. But, again, remember this. And this is a great way to gauge the brilliance of television reporting. When you report the points of the Dow instead of the percentage changes, you're appealing to a very novice audience. Right?
Well, that's being kind, Victor.
The Dow is up 200 points, or the Dow is down 200 points. I mean, that is just novice commentary, you know. I mean, it just...
Hey, that meant something when I started, and the Dow was 1,000 points. Now it's like The problem that I have, and I don't mean to cut you off, is the way they frame questions. You could actually see it in their face. You can see it in their body language. And you can hear it in the tone of the voice is that they're absolutely happy and euphoric when the market is up, and they're so serious and sullen and downtrodden when the market's down. And I guess being a trader is I am market neutral. I mean, I can make money being long. I can make money being short. I can trade spreads. I can buy, you know, I can buy options. I can buy backdated options. I can do a whole lot of things to take advantage of what I think is in the marketplace, and I can't get beyond their bias. So, yeah, I like Rick Santelli. I actually like Jim Cramer. I think he's coming from a good spot. I think he's an educator at the end of the day, and he's a great entertainer. I think he'd better serve the trading community by being at Hunter College or Stern or at Columbia Business School. But it's not my place to tell him where to go. I mean, I actually appreciate what he does. I think he's coming from
where he is.
No kidding. No kidding.
I think he's a smart guy to a degree, but I can't listen to him. It's like listening to heavy metal at 6 in the morning. I just can't do it.
Well, those were the good old days, weren't they, Victor?
But I'm not saying he's not a very knowledgeable guy. He is. He's just not somebody I can listen to.
Kathleen Hayes was great on the Fed watching stuff, but she jumped
right.
Went somewhere else.
Well, she's on Bloomberg, I think. Then.
Yeah.
I think she's on Bloomberg. By the way, I have to ask you about how long does I happen to have a dinner tonight?
Well, being that we're both part Italian, I totally understand. We're at an hour. I've just asked you the last question. I appreciate you for being available. I appreciate your friendship. You are awesome, and you're my main man. I appreciate your time today, and we'll do it again sometime.
I say the same about you. Thank you very much, Mike, and thanks for the kind words. Most of them are a little bit outdated these days, but I appreciate them anyway.
All right, we'll do it again sometime, Victor.
All right.